Welcome back if you listened to us last week, or maybe not last week, but for our episode one. This is episode two of our beloved Rover Talk podcast. I'm here with Dan, the famed Wagon Boy TD from our beloved Bring a Trailer website.
Hey, guys.
And this is Yvonne, and I'm here as usual to talk about Land Rovers, which is kind of our cup of tea. So today we wanted to talk about owning a Land Rover, and more specifically, owning a classic Land Rover. Now, I know that each person is going to have their favorite. Each person is going to like one kind over another, one model over another, one style over another. But we wanted to go specifically into two different groups, which is A, the series Rovers, which are a great variety of them. And our second section is going to be about classic Range Rovers and Discoveries. So, to not keep blabbering on, Dan, tell us about series Rovers.
Sure. So, a lot of you know the series as, you know, the original, the iconic Land Rover that started in the late 40s. So I was going to kind of go through the different series and when they came about, and the most popular within those. But just a quick review or an idea. The series one.
Wait a second, Dan. Let me stop you. How many series trucks have you had?
Five.
Currently in the stable?
Just one. I narrowed it down to one.
Oh, that's nice. I've actually got one on Bring a Trailer right now.
I have seen that. It's actually it's pretty beautiful.
Anyway, sorry I interrupted you. Let's get on to the series.
All right. So the series one started in 1948, ran through 51, and it began as a 80-inch, almost 10 inches smaller than what had become, you know, the popular 88. The second series ran from 58 to 61, and at that time the 109 had been introduced. We had previously had a 107 in the first series.
So real quickly here, yeah. I'll chime in.
Sure.
So here's the thing about Land Rover back then didn't name the car anything. They were basically 80 or 87 or 80, well, 86 would be the series one, 88, 109, 110. This is actually the wheelbase, that is the length between the axles. So they would basically call it a Land Rover 88 or 80 or 86 or 109. And then since they evolved the model, they would call it a series. So Dan was referring to series one or a series two, and that's how they became named. But officially, for example, when you buy one from Europe or at least in Spain, the model designation in the Land Rover is actually the wheelbase. So when you buy a series Rover, no matter what series it is, it's going to say on the title 88 or 109.
So it won't even say, it won't say a series, right?
Nothing. Just 88 model, 88 or 109 or 86 if it's a series one.
You know, I don't think I've ever even looked at my titles, actually. I think it just says, in America, I think it just says Land Rover.
Well, the state of Illinois is kind of weird because sometimes they decide to put a model on it and sometimes they don't. I'm pretty adamant when I do my imports that they do, but sometimes they don't want to.
Yeah.
Kind of lazy.
Yeah, that's Illinois. So back to the series. So series two ran from 58 to 61. And then the series 2A, which is, you know, pretty much the most common and most available pretty much around the world, mainly because it ran for almost 10 years. They made close to 500,000. It was pretty common and, you know, it was very popular. And then Series 3, which ran from 71 to, I believe, 85, which several different, you know, engine variations within there. One thing I did forget was the NADA, which is the North American Dollar Area series, which was made for the North American market, which began in 67 with the 109 model, and then they produced the 88, which, you know, ran at least until 74. But the 109 is probably the most sought after, just mainly because of the great engine that it had, and they only produced, I believe, about 800 of those.
There's also, now that you're talking about country-specific designations, we'll go in a later episode into Santana, but Santana are the Spain-made Land Rovers. But in Spain, there were Series 2A, actually was made until 1975, and in fact, early 75 was when the Series 3 was introduced, so they actually overlapped. In fact, in Spain, you could buy in 1975 a Series 2A or a Series 3, depending on what it is that you found at dealerships. So even though in almost the rest of the world and other production areas, you know, Land Rover Series trucks were made in South Africa, New Zealand, and various other places, in Spain, they went to 1975.
And as we know, all left-hand drive, which is, you know, pretty great for the North American market as well. But we'll get into Santanas at a later time and why we think they're a great value and a great truck. So I also wanted to kind of touch base on, since I've owned a few and own one now, I kind of wanted to talk about why I like them and kind of day-to-day things that you need to do to take care of your Land Rover.
Quick question, Dan.
Yeah.
Do you remember if the original, all the series sold diesel and gas engines?
Well, so the diesel actually didn't come until, I think, into the 50s. Then you could buy a diesel, I think it was like 57. You could buy like this 2.0, you know, as we know, isn't like the greatest engine. But you could start buying diesel in 57. But the North American market was only petrol. But overseas, you could buy the diesel starting in like the late 50s.
Oh, that's cool.
Yep. So as we talked about earlier, I've had a few series. I've had the 2As, a 2, and currently run a Series 3. Some people, you know, when I'm either on like Bring a Trailer or some other website, people ask me, well, Dan, why do you have the Series 3 over the other ones that you've had? And for me personally, it's a combination of the three that I have is, you know, it has a synchro gearbox, which, you know, it's not like it makes it like super easy, but, you know, it does make it a little bit more convenient because I do trail mine at my farm. And I found that it's a little easier to run that way without having to gear down and double clutch. Again, we'll talk about double clutching at another time. But so the Series 3, for me, I like as well because, you know, some of you may have seen the setup that my Series 3 has, but, you know, it has a hardtop cargo. It has the soft dash, which a lot of people don't like. They usually like the, you know, the stylish hard dash, which, you know, I like. But for me, when I'm trailing or I'm on road trips, I actually prefer to have areas where I can put, you know, stuff, my map or my phone or anything that I can carry within that dash. So for me, there's just something about the Series 3 that altogether the package I prefer.
I have to disagree with you here, Dan.
I know. I mean, and a lot of people do. A lot of people are like, how can you not love, you know, the simple metal dash?
And don't get me wrong. I love any series car.
Yeah.
But for me, it's almost more about the aesthetics of it. I prefer the inboard headlights. And
well, and as you've seen, I I'm an oddity. I run both inboard and outboard lights on mine because I go into the woods, and I didn't want to add like fog lights on my rack. Like I wanted a little bit extra light, but
And guess what? Some Santanas in the transition years from Series 2 to Series, well, Series 2A to Series 3, or wait, that would be, it would be better phrased or more accurate to say in the transition to from, and I believe this might have been up to 69, 70 when all Series 2A had outboard lights. That is, for those of you that are thinking inboard and outboard are the lights on the fenders or inside right next to the grill. Some Santanas actually had both sets of lights from the factory. Now, I think this is probably because they had parts left over that they needed to use.
100%. 100%. They had the wings with the lights and the radiator piece, which, you know, is mounted together in the center.
And you're going to call me stupid because I passed on one of those because I thought it was weird before I knew that it could be a factory from the factory like that. I passed on one of those. I was dirt cheap about 5 years ago.
A lot of people just don't like it aesthetically. But like I said, I got to a point where with my series, I use my Series 3 every weekend, as you know. I'm constantly doing road trips or, you know, going off road on my farm.
You can follow Dan, by the way, on Instagram on WagonBoyTD. You can take a look at his pictures. He likes to portray his farm trips, and they're actually pretty cool.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I'm fortunate to have that sort of access to off-roading on my property. So let's kind of just briefly talk about owning one and what sort of like level you need to kind of be at to own one. I always say a little bit of confidence goes a long, long way when it comes to owning a series or basically any car, really. And especially a series, it's really, really easy to take care of 90% of the day-to-day, or what I like to say, my spring needs, because I store mine over the winter, and so, you know, every spring, you know, I have a checklist of things that I check and run through.
And wait a second.
Yeah.
You have no mechanical training, right? Because I have none whatsoever.
I mean, the only mechanical training that I've had was, you know, growing up in the 70s, I had a father who worked on cars. He taught me everything I knew about my 72 2002 BMW. You know, all the cars that I had when I was growing up living at home with my father, everything I learned from the basics, I learned from him. And, you know, as we know, as we live in the age of YouTube, you know, you can take a good amount from there if you know what you're looking for, because there's a lot of bad advice on there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but with a little bit of confidence and not being afraid to ask questions of people who run and own these things, it's pretty easy to do the majority of your work.
But I love that you touched on the people. One of the cool things about the whole Land Rover community in general is that almost 100% of the people are always willing to help. And, you know, you'll find people that will help you actually come over to your house and help you do something. And you might find somebody but mostly almost everybody will help you, will respond to your questions, will give you their little tips. And that really makes a strong community. And that doesn't necessarily mean through a different, you know, through an owner's club or anything like that. Just, you know, reaching out to people that you see videos on or reaching out through Instagram, you know, take a look at your, look for a Series 2As and then reach out to the owners. And most people, if not all, will help you. So that's actually a really cool thing.
And
Dan helps a lot of people, by the way.
When you get two people together, I mean, I always say, you know, what I don't know, the other person's going to know. And so if you help people, more than likely that person's going to help you back. And, you know, that's kind of how you learn things. But do you want me to kind of give a list of things that I kind of do?
Yeah, I think that's a real good thing.
Okay, so since I do run mine off-road and, you know, through this creek that I have, and through mud and everything. So at least every couple of weeks, and I know it kind of sounds like a chore, but since the series, all series run on drum brakes, one of the key things that you that I like to do and I think is kind of recommended is, you know, take a look at your drums. You know, you'd be surprised how much crap, if, especially if you're running through mud, how much crap kind of built up in your shoes and your brakes. And, you know, the more you take off your drums, you know, the easier it becomes. I'm a little, and Ivan knows this, I'm a little anal when it comes to maintenance on my cars. And so I kind of go above and beyond. But usually brakes and stuff are something that that I like to double check. And obviously all your fluids, whether it be your cooling. Series trucks definitely need to be checked. I check it every couple weeks. That's something easy to do. Changing the oil, you know, every couple seasons. Like this last year I did it, but usually I'll do it like every other season, because it's not like I'm running, you know, 10,000 miles, you know, in the season.
And these are all things that you can do with basic set of tools. You don't need a lift of any type. You probably just need a jack or a couple of jack stands if you're going to check your brakes or your drums.
Yeah.
And the good thing about most series trucks, well, all of them, is that you can actually, you know, change all the fluids from underneath without having to lift it up.
Because there's so much clearance, you just slide in, slide out. And the only thing that's not, like, and it's not really that big of a deal, but you'd be surprised, like, how hard it is to actually reach into a series bay most of the time. Like, this past spring, I kind of did a full, I changed the plugs, I did the wires, I replaced the starter. Like, I literally top to bottom was able to do, you know, pretty much everything myself. Super easy. And one other thing that I'd recommend is always carry or have an extra solenoid in your back stock, because series tend to be temperamental every once in a while. And that literally is like a 20-minute replace. And I was, just a quick story, I was out on the road, kind of far from home, just happened to have a solenoid with me and was able to swap it out in like 2 seconds. So,
and that's a starter solenoid, right?
Correct. Yep. So that's pretty easy. And then I also replaced, you know, the oil filter, you know, the oil.
So, you know, you know what the trick is to having easier access into your bay, right?
Well, yeah, I have like a little bench that
I stand. You don't need a bench. All you need to do is a couple of towels. You put one on your front bumper, and you will put one on top of the radiator, and you sit down, and you access all that you need to get.
Oh, brother.
And that's – I'm telling you, it's like a charm. It's even better access. The fenders are so flat, you can even have a third towel and leave your drink on there.
I mean, I guess it's easier, too, if you don't have, you know, a winch in there or the apron.
Still, just stand on it. Yeah. Remember, those bumpers are meant to hold all the weight in the world.
I've stood on that before, but okay.
But well, anyway, so the other, you know, a little bit more, you know, all of these things are easily done, you know, by basic mechanical skills or you don't even need to have them, actually.
I will, and I kind of tell this to people, like, if you don't have any mechanical like training or, you know, deep engine training, or if you have to take the valve cover off and you've never worked on an engine, I always say have someone else who has a little bit more experience. Don't start watching YouTube videos on, you know, interior stuff. It'll cost you a lot less if you have someone who specializes in rebuilding these, you know, although very basic 2.25 liter engines.
The other thing that I've always done on series trucks that I think is really good is if you're using it, especially off-road, you want to make sure your transfer case is well lubricated. Now, here's the thing. The angle design of the transfer case, if you look at it from underneath
which,
the car.
Which actually I lubricate that every year as well. I should have mentioned that, but
I figured
100%. Like,
I figured as much, but there's a design fault. So no matter what type of gasket you want to put on that transfer case cover, no matter what type you want to make your own gasket, unless you weld it, there is no way that is not going to leak. Now that's a common thing for Range Rovers.
Yeah, it's going to leak.
Everything's going to leak. But anyway, and the way is actually kind of funny because it's actually underneath the middle front seat. Where you take your seat cushion off.
Which is genius. The access, although you can't just pour in, you know, your fluid. I mean, I have this trick where I use a bug sprayer and pump it in, and it, like, works, you know. Usually I've seen some people try to, like, jimmy rig, like, a funnel at a direction. But, like, if you just use – I should post it at some point, but I just use, like, this bug sprayer – put in the quantity that I need, get it in, and close it up, and you're good to go. But it's super easy to...
Those of us that have a steady hand do it by hand.
Oh, my God. No.
You can do it. No. But it's right. Dan, but that's another item that often goes unlooked on a lot of these cars because you don't think of it. You think about changing the oil or maybe the coolant. But you want to make sure that especially if you're going off-road, that your transfer case is well lubricated. And especially you want to check the level on it because they'll leak no matter what. I've tried to change the gasket several times on several different ones, and I think the most I lasted one time without one leaking was a week.
And like you said, everything leaks, and so you have to physically check it because you don't know what's leaking half the time
How ingenious of a design is it that you take your middle seat bottom cushion of the middle seat out. There's a very easy panel there that has 6 to 8 bolts. I can't remember right now off the top of my head. It might only have 4, actually.
My panel just slides right out.
Oh, it does?
Yeah. And you're in.
And then right there, you have access to the cover. Take off the bolts, and you can fill it right up through there.
Yeah.
So that's often an item that goes unlooked. But that shows you how easy these cars are to work on. Imagine trying to change the transfer case fluid on a modern SUV. You would probably need 75,000 specialty tools.
Yep.
Anyway, Dan, sorry.
No. And then, so I don't run mine in the winter. Like, I'll run it into, like, probably, like, the first snowfall. And then it goes to sleep until mid-March. And so, you know, you just want to make sure that you store it in a dry spot. I always tell people concrete in the country is not the greatest. So I always suggest, especially with series, to put canvas down or something that's going to trap the moisture from concrete, because concrete's actually, you know, pretty bad for your chassis, especially if you live in a climate like Illinois. Especially if you don't have a heated garage, it's preferred that you put something on the concrete, because what will happen is the condensation from the concrete when it gets humid will actually make your chassis rust, even though you're not running it in salt. I always just recommend just take that extra precaution and save your chassis on your series.
Even though they are easily repairable, but if you can avoid it.
Yeah, okay. I'm all about prevention. So,
by the way, in case you didn't know, you can buy a whole galvanized chassis, brand new, same as the factory galvanized. So theoretically never going to rust, for probably about $3,000, which makes it kind of cool. But all of these cars are built on the old style of construction of body on chassis. So you're always going to have body panels and certain parts of the car that are metal versus some that are in aluminum, and everything is going to be prone to rust. So that's always a big issue, depending on the climate where you live. I mean, if you live in southern Arizona, you don't really care about this. But anyway, most of the country has a winter or some humidity.
And talking about parts, literally every part is available especially from a 2A on. You literally can get replacements for every part.
Dan, do you remember that time we went out on the Santana in Chicago, a 1983 Santana, which is what they call the Series 4 for the Santanas, has a few little upgrades. We'll go into Santana a different episode, but Dan came over and we took it out for a drive, and one of the clutch cylinders, the one that's behind the pedal, failed, unfortunately. Well, that part cost me $18 on Amazon.
Exactly. Amazon, literally. I just replaced the master and slave, although I know we can't really say that anymore, but we kind of have to because we know what that means as far as the cylinders go with the clutch, but I just replaced those on my Series 3, and altogether parts, I think, was under $50. And replaced them myself. There's one little tricky bit in there that will frustrate most people, but it's still doable.
The other, to recap a little bit, and that way we can get on to, I think we've touched a lot about the series. Are we missing something that you want to mention, Dan?
Nope. I think just always, if you're looking to buy one, and we'll get this in the later episode, is do as much research prior before pulling the trigger.
Yeah. So the other thing that real quickly that I wanted to mention, this applies to all of classic Land Rovers, is that the vast majority of parts are readily available and are cheap
overseas. Nothing against my friends at Rovers North and some of our American sponsors. I love them. I buy stuff from them in a pinch. But you can get parts anywhere around the world, and they're still, relatively cheap.
They're very cheap. So I hope that helped everybody get an idea of what a series truck really is. We'll go deeper into the series, and hopefully we'll do a couple of another secondary set of episodes about buyer's guides, because I think between Dan and I, we've probably bought over, I don't know, probably 50, 60 Rovers between the two of us.
And we've made mistakes that – I didn't know any better, mainly because it was pre-internet, but
I've only made one. Well, not really. No, don't get me wrong. I've had a lot of luck. Anyway, so let's get on to the other few cars that we wanted to cover in this episode of Owning a Land Rover. So I wanted to go into, and Dan is going to help me a lot with this one too, into classic Range Rovers and classic Discoveries. Now, I know we say classic Discoveries, but Discovery, I'm going to go into what's Gen 1 or Generation 1.
And what year does that go up to technically?
So starting in Europe, it was 1989, which were the first ones that came out to the market. Most countries in Europe got 1990 as their first model year. And theoretically, it goes all the way up to 1998. But there's some purists that will say it goes up to 1994. 1994 is the year in which the U.S. started getting Discoveries.
Right.
So
that would be me. I call them pre-gen ones because,
So there's a little bit of a variation in what each place considers Gen 1. So Gen 1 in the United States from 1994 going forward. Gen 1, rest of the world, especially Europe, 1989, 90. There's a bit of a yearly overlap. Land Rover didn't really respect years all that much for model designations, at least back then. Now it's a whole new thing. But anyway, so I wanted to give a brief overview. So both Discoveries and Range Rovers, and the reason I'm bunching them together is because for a lot of years, they share engines and they share a lot of common parts. That doesn't necessarily mean you're going to want to buy parts from one for the other, but the years of experience and owning one is going to be very similar.
You could literally strip the shell off a Range Rover and a Disco and essentially be looking at the same vehicle.
Thank you, Dan. Exactly. But I want to focus. So the early, we touched on Range. We went in depth into Range Rovers. Range Rovers started at 68, 67, 68, 69. And those were early V8 Buick engines with carburetors. Those are rare. And honestly, those are going to give you more of a feel of a series truck than they're going to give you of a modern Range Rover. And while they're great cars, but they had one main issue, which were the carburetors, which were the dual Stromberg carburetors. Now, don't get me wrong. Now, that's not an issue. It's just cars with carburetors always require a little bit more maintenance than cars that are fuel injected, just because of the nature that the carburetors can get crap in them. You have to change the needles, the valves, the floats, and everything inside. And synchronizing those two carburetors always.
That's a talent. I mean, the average always a skill. Collector.
I can do it on a Mini, but it has to be the single. The duals are a challenge. In fact, I tried to synchronize the other day two carburetors on a 57 NGA, two HS4s. I gave up. Yeah. But I think there might be something wrong with the timing, which I can't move the distributor. Anyway, that's a whole different deal. Anyway, so I want to get to this. So the cool thing about Discoveries, Gen 1 Discoveries, and let's say Range Rovers from 1985 on, or 84, 83, 82, 81, which is where they were fuel injected, is that they're very usable cars day to day. There's going to be you have your 3.5 or 3.9 or 4.2 V8 gas. The Discovery got the 3.9. The Range Rover had 3.5 at the beginning, then 3.9, then 4.2 V8 gas engines, fuel injected. And then you're going to have your diesels, which the Range Rover got the 2.4 VM, 2.5 VM, and then later the 200 TDI and 300 TDI. Discovery's got the 200 and the 300 TDI. They did not get the VM engine. So that way we have a little bit of a clear designation, but all of these models can be used daily, automatic or manual. And honestly, and I want to go here a little bit first into some of the basics that you can do for both engines. So the basics that you can do is you can change out your belts. You're going to need somebody to help you out just to get the right tension on the belt. If you're very skilled, you can do it by yourself, but it takes you a little bit. Your belts are easy to do. Your water pump and thermostat are right up front on all of those models. It's just removing the fan and then taking out the water pump. Water pumps should be considered service items, in case you didn't know that. You should change your water pump on an older car, especially on an older Rover, once every 2 years, 3 years at the most, depending on the mileage that you do, because they're dirt cheap, and you don't want your water pump failing on you, because that could overheat your engine and cause you to have to throw it away.
Yep.
So those are basic. That's basic stuff that you can do on. And then obviously the fuel pump is something that you can also do rather easily, because especially in the Range Rovers, it's in the trunk. All you need to do is take off a panel with about 8 bolts and you can lift it out. You can put it back in. You can even have it repair just parts if you don't want to change out the whole thing. That's a pretty easy thing to do.
And is that pump on all Range Rovers? Will it always be in the back?
On all Range Rovers.
Okay.
All Range Rovers have the pump in the back. The gas tank in Range Rovers is underneath the rear trunk. And it's metal up until 1992. And in 1992, they changed it over and it's actually plastic. So you can actually get a replacement tank for about $80. And the plastic ones are probably better than the metal ones. But anyway, those are things you can. Your alternator is not difficult to change. There's easy access to that. You can also access your alternator and change it out. All you need to do is loosen up the belts, loosen up the tensioners, which are old-fashioned, where you have to undo the bolts and then move it. And those are things that you can do, that anybody can do with your basic. Obviously, your oil changes. You can change your oil. You can change your differential oils as well. You've got, as in many differentials, one hole up top, one hole in the bottom. You empty it out through the bottom. Make sure to unscrew the top first.
I think you just did a whole new suspension package on a classic, right?
I did. I was going to get to that in a second.
Okay.
So the one thing I do want to warn people is that with automatic transmissions on the Range Rover Classics, when you need to change out your transmission fluid and your filter, which you need to do your filter, you're going to have to remove a cross member. So that requires a little bit more effort. It can still be done on your back on the ground, but you're probably going to need a rubber mallet. And you're probably going to need a pump jack to be able to put the cross member back once you're done. It's just you cannot remove the automatic transmission sump without taking out the cross member. So that's always one of the things that you want to remember, that you might need to just go to a shop and say, hey, swap this out. They should be able to knock it out in about an hour. And it's always good to have a new automatic transmission filter. Anyway, and the other thing that you can do, which is actually pretty easy, although it takes a little bit of time, is changing out your brakes and suspension. So the Range Rover and the Discovery share, and I'm not 1,000% sure on this, but I'm pretty sure they have the same type of front and rear axle. If not, the way they come together and come apart are very similar. And changing out your coil and your shock on both the front and the back is going to change the ride of your classic Range Rover dramatically. It's a simple yet inexpensive. So you can get your factory parts. You don't have to do any upgrades. And I don't recommend upgrades, because here's the thing about upgrading your suspension on a Range Rover Classic. It's going to be harder. And if it's harder, it ruins the ride.
Yep.
You always want to go original. And
because you want to always have some sort of float. I mean,
well, yeah. If not, it's not a Range Rover.
Exactly.
And the other thing too is that the long wheelbase has different springs in the back than the short wheelbase or the two door, which are basically the same. Just know that, because they weigh a little bit more, so they're actually a little bit stiffer springs to cope with the weight. So just make sure you order the right ones. Anyway.
And you had a friend help you, or
I had
some of it.
Yeah, you know, it's much easier with a two-man job, and I'm going to tell you why. It's really stupid. So those of you that have done this before on a different car, you'll know that the top bolt and screw of the suspension tower is rotating. So you will try to take off the nut, and the screw will turn with it because it's loose from underneath, which you kind of have to loosen it up, or because that is directly the part that goes on to your shock absorber. And if your shock absorber is a little bit old, it will have already given way. So that when you try to take off the bolt from the screw at the top of the shock absorber, at the top of the suspension tower, it all turns together. So it's easier if somebody can grab with a pair of pliers and hold on to that bolt so that you can take your nut off. And that's the detail that makes you need another person.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's people that have a system for getting that off, but I wasn't smart enough. I needed somebody else.
And plus, it's always better to have a friend around anyway.
Well, so you came to see it a day too late, or else I would have put you to work. Because I already gotten it off at that point.
I knew what I was doing.
Anyway, parts are very cheap. I think I did the whole suspension, I believe, was probably less than $400 shipping included. And that's new springs and new shocks for front and rear. The other thing that's very easy to do are your brakes. Now, your challenge here is that in order for you to remove the front brake rotors, they are bolted very heavily onto the back of the whole axle. I don't know what you would call that. But anyway, you're going to need some rough tools to get the old brake rotors off. But you can also do what I did, which is take the whole thing off, take the whole assembly off, take it to a shop, and in 2 minutes they've got it off for you, and they put the new ones on, and they usually you smile at them, and they don't charge you. So, but all of those things are super easy to do. You know, I mean, it's going to take you a little bit of time. Suspension takes a little bit of time. You have to jack the car up on the frame, and you want to use a bottle jack to separate the axle from the body a little bit more so that the spring pops right out. If not, you can use spring compressors of any type. So there's lots of different options. It just depends on kind of how you want to do it. But that's a huge upgrade. But, you know, the cool thing about – and the Disco is the same way. The cool thing about the Disco and the Range Rover, anything that's got a fuel injected, you know, 3.5, 3.9, or – and even the carbureted engines too, or 4.2, are cars that you can use every day. And for those of you that think, well, can I use this as a daily driver? Yes, you can. In fact, you can. But just remember, it's always going to be a 25 to 30 to 35 to 40-year-old car, which means that things are going to go wrong a lot more often than you would with a modern car. So can you use it as a daily driver? Absolutely.
So are you saying that I shouldn't be using my 200 TDI all manual as a daily driver like I do?
I'm saying that you should continue to use that, undercoat it, and use it in the winter.
Oh, Lordy.
Anyway. So that's kind of with the gas engine. Those things are easy to do, and so Dan, what of all of these things, what have you done?
On my Disco.
Well, on your Disco, on your Classic.
Well, the Classics. I've been really fortunate, and as we mentioned in the first episode, it's from Spain, and I got it from Ivan. So I've been really fortunate that it came with some really great service already to it. So the only thing that I really had to do is just general maintenance, which is change the oil, all the filters, and then a couple of like cosmetic things interior. But like engine wise, I've been pretty fortunate where I haven't had to do anything. I know you keep telling me, well, let's change out the suspension.
We'll do that this winter.
And, you know, I'll think about it. It rides great.
The other thing that I forgot to mention is when you're doing the brakes, you're going to need to bleed the brakes. And bleeding the brakes on a Range Rover is a little bit more complex because there are two bleed nipples per caliper. They have a very specific order that you can find anywhere online. And if you're like me, that I'm for some reason I can't understand the mechanism of bleeding the brakes, I literally changed the brakes. I did the calipers as well. I put everything together and I drove it. I made sure it stopped, and it did. And I drove it at like 25 miles an hour to a shop near me and had them bleed the brakes.
That's the one thing that I hate doing is bleeding the brakes. You know, I've replaced entire systems on cars before, and I just replaced the line on an L322. We'll get to that later. And the one thing I didn't want to do was bleed the brake. I did everything else, but it's like they're just so futzy at times. It drives me crazy.
For me, it's one of those things that professionals can do it so quickly and so easily. You almost like love to watch a mechanic do it. Like, oh, no, they get in there like, no, press the pedal.
Yeah,
they got their systems down.
Yep.
And I wanted to touch quickly, too, on diesels. So for those of you that are less familiar with diesels, now, Dan and I are very familiar. Dan has two diesels right now.
I do. I have a VM 2.5 and a 200 TDI, which is my dream, my total dream engine. As I just mentioned, I daily drive it every day to work. It's a manual, and I 1,000% love it.
So the good thing, the I mean, we were having this discussion on Dan and I were having this on the auction feed of a Santana diesel that I have right now listed on Bring a Trailer with somebody else. And, you know, the U.S. has maybe not understood the diesel in terms of daily cars, more on like the trucks and industrial vehicles, stuff like that. Here's the thing about diesel. Diesel, yes, will give you less horsepower, more torque, probably, depending on the size of the engine in comparison to a gas
right.
diesel. Better mileage, more miles per gallon.
Double if you're talking a 3.5 versus a 200 or
3.9.
It's double the mileage.
And yes, they are going to smoke a little bit more. Keep in mind that a diesel engine works on compression. There's no spark explosion, so a lot less of the actual fuel is burned. And of course, diesel is a little bit dirtier fuel than gasoline. So if you understand that, then you understand the diesel a little bit better. Cool thing about it is that, excuse me, there's no spark plugs, and you have to deal a lot less with timing issues. Now, the reason for this is because timing in a diesel engine is set inside the diesel injection pump, and it's a lot harder for the diesel injection pump to lose its timing than it is for a distributor in any type of car. That maybe you're doing something down there and you move it, or you replace the spark plugs and then you got to change it. So there's actually, I would say, in my user opinion, a lot less service, daily service, or things that could go wrong in a diesel engine versus a gas, just because of their pure simplicity.
Yep. Yes, as far as the Range Rover engines, can't say the same for my Mercedes, but that's a whole nother ballgame.
Yeah, well, you know, Mercedes was always technologically advanced.
Yeah.
Anyway, whether you're considering or you have a diesel Discovery or a diesel Range Rover, they're going to be pretty easy to maintenance, and you're going to want to worry about the same things. You want to make sure that the oil is changed. You want to, of course, use the right type of oil, and I'm not going to say a certain specific type. I'd say look at the manual, the temperature conditions, and how you're going to use it.
And how many miles you have on your engine.
And how many, exactly, and how many miles are going to, and that's going to help you decide the correct type of oil you want to use.
The heavier weight, the more miles you have.
So. Yeah, exactly. And everything else is going to be basically the same. You're going to want to, you know, you want to change your oil, water pump, thermostat. You know, keep in mind that depending on your engine, you're going to have a different thermostat because the engine temperatures are going to be a little bit different. And whether it's a 200 TDI or it's a 2.5 VM or 2.4 VM or 300 TDI.
You know, 300, and we'll can talk about that later, but, you know, you get the intercooler and you can, you know, do all those fancy upgrades with that. But
true, true. That engine is a little bit more advanced. And every once in a while, and this is, and I always say this with a lot of classic vehicles, since you there's a lot of history that you don't know about it, you kind of repair as you need to, right?
Yep.
So your fluids you want to change regularly, and your stuff like your water pump and like that. But, you know, all of a sudden you're going to hear a little grind at the wheel and you're going to think, shit, it's a wheel bearing. Or you're going to hear your brakes squeal or kind of scratch, and, you know, you got to change your brakes. So you kind of have to think about it as I don't have a service schedule. I'm going to do the basics to keep the engine well lubricated and running well. And then as I go, I will need to tackle certain issues. The other thing here is, and I want to very briefly touch on this, is electrical issues. Now, Gen 1 Discoveries and Land Rover, classic Land Rovers, are actually very simple electronically. You do get an electrical issue here and there, and it's more complex and probably more common in gas engines and later model cars than it is with turbo diesels.
Well, the Lucas Prince of Darkness hasn't arrived quite yet, so, you know, you're pretty good on the earlier ones.
But, I mean, if you have a decently skilled mechanic or you can find, you know, somewhere that is good with electrics, and that's really easy to do. Just look up online and look at your forums and see where people recommend.
And just
right?
real quickly, I know we're kind of running out of time, but that kind of touches on the point of it. If you're new to Rovers, I always suggest people find a specialist prior to
absolutely
pulling the trigger, or at least find someone like myself or someone that you know that knows Land Rovers. Don't go in blindly, because more often than not, you'll be discouraged if you buy the wrong.
Yeah, that's always true. And never buy a Rover without getting underneath. Or putting it on a lift and looking to see what's underneath.
Yep. And please drive a diesel before buying one ever, because a lot of people are disappointed. Even though I love it, people can't tell the difference.
Yeah, that, you know, it's. I know we're running out of time, but it's funny that you mentioned that, because we were having that discussion about series diesel versus series gas. Now
it's the same drive. Sorry to say, but
it is. It is. There's on paper 6 horsepower difference between a 2.25 Series 2A or Series 3 diesel and gas engine on a series trucks. So that means that the horsepower output, the drivability, is basically the same.
Because you're not going on the highway with either. So
yeah, you're not going on the highway with either, because they weren't designed for that, and you're probably going to be pretty scared. And the car's probably, you know, if you're lucky, you might make it to like 50, 55 downhill and coasting and overdrive and everything like that.
Well, that's a whole nother
That's
story.
A whole nother episode. Yeah. Anyway, but there is a noticeable difference in power, a more noticeable difference in power, diesel versus gasoline in both discos and classic Range Rovers. So there's, for example, to give you an example, the 200 TDI, 2.5 VM, and the 300 TDI have power bands between 115 horsepower and 130. Your 3.9 liter V8 of the same year gasoline engine is giving you 170 to 175 horsepower. So if you think about it, there is a noticeable difference there. And when you drive them, yes, there is a lot of power difference. But then again, it's not a race car. You're not looking to go fast, or you're not specifically. And all of them are highway capable. All of them can be put on the highway at 75 miles an hour, and you're fine.
Yep.
So it's all a question of what combination you want, diesel, whether your gas mileage, what you're going to use it for, if you want a manual, if you want an automatic. Anyway, so real quickly, Dan, to end this one, have you seen something interesting lately on any auction website? I know I'm going to bring something up.
I mean, other than
My absolutely fantastic 30,000 mile original Series 2A from 73. Yes, other than that,
A lot of TWR classics actually have been popping up on cars and bids, bring a trailer. So
remind us about the TWR.
It's a racing package. I kind of equate it to AMG for Range Rover Classic. Came in Beluga, which is the more common, and Brooklyn's Green. But a couple have popped up this week on both sites. So, you know, those always catch my eye just because, you know, they're pretty rare.
Well, I'm going to pick out one of Dan's least favorite cars, knowing that he's going to give me the look from the other side of the table. But there is a green Range Rover P38.
No.
2000.
Nope.
And I believe is it the 50th anniversary? No, it's the 40th.
Yeah, no, it's the 50th.
50th anniversary would be like 2002?
Yep.
Or 2000. No, 1998.
It's
sorry.
A 2000.
It's a 2000?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, 50th anniversary, whatever, Land Rover 50th anniversary. 30th anniversary.
Sorry.
Anyway. Now, cosmetically, the car looks great.
Not underneath.
We'll go into P38s in another episode because I think they're a very cool and interesting car, and I know they have a buttload of problems.
Nope.
But Dan doesn't like them. I keep on saying, every time I find one that's an Alpine White that would go very well
with all
your other Alpines, I think, Dan, you need to put this into the collection. Anyway, I think it's a cool car. Yes, underneath it doesn't look that good. It's going to need a little bit of work underneath. But at the price that it's going to go to, which is probably under $6,000, and even though it has a lot of miles, I think that's a very cool car.
The new owner better buy the alternator right now because I'm sure it's
they're
gonna...
cheap. I changed the one for what, like $300?
I know.
Among other electronical gremlins that I went through. Anyway, we wanted to choose one car that we thought was interesting for the end of this episode. We're going to be back with episode number 3. And off the top of my mind, I can't really remember what episode 3 is about. So we're going to leave it at that. Now, we've opened up an email, which is rovertalk55@gmail. If you want to send us comments, questions, you want to, you know, we accept everything from negative to positive and everything in between. So please do. We'll share some of these ones and some of these questions or address some of the questions, issues, complaints, whatever you want. Corrections that we may have because, you know, you may know more than we do, which is likely.
100%.
So please do. If you have corrections on, hey, you know what? Yvonne said that the this was, yes, please do send it to us. And Dan, thank you for sharing all your information
of
about
course.
Your series.
Always.
We're going to go a little bit more into the series trucks, which I think might be our second favorite after the Range Rover. But anyway, we'll see you on the next episode. Remember, rovertalk55@gmail. And if you want to follow Dan, he is WagonBoyTD on both
Instagram,
both on Bring a Trailer and on Instagram. Follow his stuff. It's pretty cool.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.